Next case is 08-853 and 858 State of Ohio versus Jessica DeRove.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rivera.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Ralph Rivera. Along with Attorney Wobman, we represent the state of Ohio and the Mahoning County Prosecutor's Office. At this time, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
What's your time?
Today, the state requests this honorable court to reverse the Seven District's decision in vacating appellee's conviction for two reasons. The first reason being that the horizontal gaze nystagmus test was conducted in substantial compliance by Trooper Martin, as the National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration does not require a minimum 68-second time requirement to be in compliance. And for the second reason, Trooper Martin may consider the results of a portable breath test, otherwise known as a PBT, in making a totality of the circumstances analysis and establishing probable cause to arrest an individual for violating or driving while under the influence of alcohol. Moving first to the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. As this court has previously recognized, the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, or otherwise known as the HGN, is one of the most recognized as the most accurate field test in determining whether a person is driving while impaired. First, the NHTSA manual does not require a 68-second minimum time requirement.
And nowhere is that manual in evidence in this case?
In this case, it was admitted as State's Exhibit 1 or A. It was admitted. And nowhere in that manual does there require a 68-second minimum time requirement for an arresting officer to be in compliance.
Well, both sides have added up the time it takes for each of the steps, and you both come out, this sounds like a math issue, both come out with a different number. So I guess we make our own number. We read it and decide whether there is some minimum time, right?
Mr. Chief Justice, that is possible. You could look at it as a math problem. However, the NHTSA manual, in the three separate stages of the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, being smooth pursuit, maximum deviation, and onset of nystagmus prior to 45 degrees, only maximum deviation specifically states a minimum time requirement, and that being 4 seconds, holding the eye at maximum deviation for a minimum of 4 seconds, maximum of 30 seconds. The other two stages of that test, the manual talks, it specifically states approximate times as being the times that should be used as a speed to move the eye from left to right. Therefore, in those cases, when it speaks to approximate times, that is not a minimum hard fast requirement.
Here, didn't the arresting officer admit that he abbreviated a couple of the steps?
In this case, there was only one, I believe there was testimony as to one stage that he did not comply with. That is, I believe it's, the stop, he did not stop and verify the nystagmus. That is the third step, nystagmus prior to 45 degrees. That is the only stage of the HGN test that the officer testified as not being in compliance with. That alone, the officer is still within substantial compliance, as substantial compliance is now the standard for admissibility of the HGN test. In determining probable cause. With that alone, the Seventh District erred in finding that he was not in substantial compliance with the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. The officer did, there was some cross-examination regarding the minimum time requirement. The officer, after Attorney Coker finished his cross-examination and added up the times, the officer testified that, yes, those are the calculations that Attorney Coker made, but then he goes on to state directly after that that the average time for the horizontal gaze nystagmus test is anywhere from 45 to 50 seconds. That being said, the record was pretty clear that Trooper Martin took 44 seconds, and which is in the record and on the videotape. If that is the minimum time requirement of 45 to 50 seconds, surely 44 seconds would be in substantial compliance as the satisfying standard that the Ohio legislature has set forth. And if this court would find a minimum time requirement, it's the state's position that any minimum time requirement that is found would be strict compliance rather than substantial compliance. Therefore, if, for instance, an officer does not complete one stage of the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. For instance, in this case, it was the onset of the nystagmus prior to 45 degrees. You have two other stages that were properly done, and in this case was indicated, four clues were indicated in those two prior stages prior to the third one. And as this court has previously recognized, that four out of six clues on the horizontal gaze nystagmus test is indicative of a blood alcohol level of above a 0.10. Therefore, in that case, the officer would clearly be within substantial compliance. And in considering taking that the horizontal gaze nystagmus test into consideration in this case, add that together with the strong odor of alcohol, the red glassy eyes, and the admission to alcohol consumption that was taken that occurred at 2:34 on a Saturday morning. Certainly, there was probable cause for the officer to arrest the appellee at that time.
Counsel, if I understand your argument in your briefs, is that that alone was enough to establish probable cause to arrest? We've also accepted a proposition on the portable breath test, which I think a lot of members of this court are interested in discussion on that. But before you start on that, I was wondering what kind of foundation did you lay for the admission of the evidence in that, even as to probable cause?
As to the totality of the probable cause?
No. For the portable breath test, was there testimony as to how it worked and how you use it, and that there's some indicia of reliability, and that it was used in accordance with the instructions on this particular occasion?
In this case, there was not.
All right. Does that end our discussion right there? If there's no foundation how it works, why would we get to the legal issue?
It may stop it in this case, but just to go on, this court should not be the end all of that discussion. We should not outlaw portable breath tests completely.
Well, wouldn't we just be giving an advisory opinion then, if there's no foundation as to how it works, so it's not properly considered even in probable cause, why would we render a decision as to whether it's admissible in a probable cause hearing then?
I don't think that would be an advisory opinion per se. If there was, for instance, if there was a proper foundation laid and it was shown that it was reliable, in that case, the PBT should be considered.
We have a Court of Appeals decision that says it's inherently unreliable and not admissible, so we have to deal with that. That's already out there, isn't it?
That is true. And in that opinion, the Schuller case out of the 4th District is kind of the backbone of several district courts that have come after the Schuller case that cite to Schuller and cite every reason laid out by Schuller. In Schuller, the case dealt with a portable breath test. Was a digital reading, and in that case, the defendant, the reading was actually below the per se level, and the defendant in that case wanted to admit that the results of that portable breath test at trial. What the Court of Appeals said in Shuler is that look, it's inherently unreliable, and it laid out a several different reasons of why it should not be allowed or it should not be admissible in trial. But the Shuler, the Fourth District in Shuler recognized that this court, or I'm sorry, the Fourth District Court has always recognized the portable breath test and has allowed it as a determination of probable cause only. And that is what the state would ask today, that portable breath test be allowed solely for the determination of probable cause.
Do we have a split in authority?
I'm sorry?
We have a split in authority on the appellate level?
Yes, that it was a that issue, the second proposition of law was a certified conflict between the Fourth District and the Seventh District courts. And there are several other districts that there are several districts on each side of the fence.
Counsel, where would you suggest this court go to get its information as to what the portable breath test is, how it's to operate, and what the reliability? Was there anything admitted in this case about it, a manual or anything where we can look at and say, well, this is what a portable breath test is, and this is why it's reliable or not, and why it should or should not be admitted in a probable cause? Or where do we go for our information?
In this case, because there was no testimony and there was no really any foundation to what, and I would concede that the officer never even testified to the exact model that he used. The information, which is the National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, they lay out a list of acceptable and conforming portable breath tests. There are several different manufacturers and different makes and models that are on their conforming list. In previous decisions and opinions from this court, specifically the Bresson opinion, relies heavily on NHTSA, and NHTSA is the, as this court recognizes, the governing body and the expert in field sobriety tests and OVI arrests. And going on to the argument of that the Ohio Department of Health does not recognize portable breath tests as a suitable device for evidentiary finding, the state submits that NHTSA is the expert in field sobriety testing and portable breath tests, not the Ohio Department of Health. Certainly, the Ohio Department of Health has its authority in regulating the procedures and ensuring their reliability, but NHTSA also performs that that task in testing the reliability.
And is that that information from the National Highway Transportation Safety in the record or attached to the brief or a citation to it so we know where to go?
A majority of that information is contained in the amicus brief submitted by Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Other than that, that is where most of the information comes from.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor. And if I could, I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Rivera. Mr. Coker.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Rob Coker. I'm here on behalf of Jessica DeRove. With me today is Tim Huey from the Ohio Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for him argument as well.
You need to watch your time there.
I believe when the state was discussing the horizontal gaze nystagmus test at the beginning, a couple things I would like to point out to the court. Number one, although this was a state trooper in this case, and his cruiser is equipped with a camera, this test was done off camera. We cannot see how the administration of each test is conducted. What we do have is the audio from the microphone that is on the trooper's tie. And that is that coupled with the video time marking in the corner is the only thing we have to go on as to how long each of these three phases took and how well the trooper did in administering each of these phases. That in essence also with his testimony.
Well, counsel, plenty of people were convicted of OMVI without benefit of video out at the roadside, and because it's now available, does that mean that it must be conducted and produced in order to have probable cause to take someone in and give them the certified breath analysis?
Justice Pfeiffer, what I would say is the video is available now. This technology is now available. The High State Patrol lobbied for the funds to get this equipment and have it installed in their cruisers. So
is there any case that says they have to use it?
No, I'm not aware of a case that says they have to use it. Their policies and procedures require them to use it, but I'm aware of a case where that's actually...
So if they violate their policies and procedures, does that take away probable cause?
No, I don't believe it does take away probable cause. What I'm stating here is that we have a very good piece of technology that we could not use in this case. That being the case that we're presented with, we have to go by these timings that are found in the NHTSA manual. Each of these officers goes through training.
Okay, and let me back you up one other step. There's no dispute about the probable cause to stop your client in the first place, is there?
No, this was a registration violation. I did not challenge that at the trial level. Certainly the trooper had the right to pull Mr. Rove over at that point.
And you also are not challenging the certified breathalyzer test as being inaccurate. You're just challenging getting there through probable cause.
I'm sorry.
Did you at trial challenge the breathalyzer, the certified test, once they took her into the station? Is that an issue at all?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, that was an issue in the 7th District. However, they found that issue to be moot because they found there's no probable cause to arrest to get her to the certified breathalyzer test.
So if we end up ruling against you on probable cause, does that mean we need to send it back for that second issue?
Oh, certainly. And there were significant issues that Mr. Rove brought up with the breathalyzer at the trooper barracks.
You're arguing for a specific time that is a minimum that this test must be done. Doesn't that put us back into substantial or complete compliance?
Strict,
thank you. Strict compliance, which, as you know, I dissented in Holman very strongly. The statute came down changing the standard back to substantial compliance. It sounds like you're trying to direct us back to a strict compliance standard.
Your Honor, I would like to direct you back to a strict compliance. However, I'm not here to do that today. What I would say is, in fact, this would help the court with its substantial compliance standard. There is certainly a minimum time at which these tests can be done. Certainly there are. There is no way that you can move a stimulus and have it take no time. It's certainly going to take some number of seconds.
But if you have so many different aspects, you have time, you have how it's performed, you have, you know, what the conditions were, how do we set that minimum standard? Isn't that a discretionary call with the trial judge looking at the totality of that test to decide whether it's substantial compliance or not?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. It is because with all those varying factors, all those other factors can do is serve to lengthen the time at which it would take that particular officer on that particular night with that particular driver to do that test. When we're talking about a minimum amount of time to do the test, we're talking about if the officer was a robot who was 100% efficient in all of his motions, moving the stimulus back to center, etc., that doing so and following everything in the manual, and for instance, with the onset prior to 45 degrees, finding it at 10 degrees and stopping to verify that this amount of time is what it would take. There certainly can come up with a minimum time. Now, in this case, I questioned extensively the trooper regarding his administration of this test and the timing of it. Throughout the entire questioning, the trooper agreed, and at the end he agreed, that his minimum time to conduct it would have been 68 seconds. And in fact, there was a later case, State versus Bailey, which a trooper testified during the case that the Ohio State Patrol Academy recommends 68 seconds as the timing for the horizontal gaze nystagmus test.
And we have a lot of cases where other courts have reached different time minimums on this issue. How do we come up with what is the accurate number?
The only other case that I saw where they actually came up with the number that the trooper used was in Bailey, where he said it should have been 68. It actually took him 52 seconds, and they found that that was not substantial compliance. And the other two cases I had cited were State versus Mai and State versus Embry, where there was no time given for how long it took the officer to administer the test. However, the court found that they did not substantially comply. And in this specific case, Trooper Martin admitted that on the onset prior to 45 degrees, he had failed to stop and verify that the nystagmus was continued and distinct, as he's required to under the NHTSA manual. He admitted that. So he certainly failed at least that portion of the horizontal gaze test. Now, there are two other portions. We don't know what portions he shorted Mr. Rovon, because we can't see it on the video, but certainly he did. It took him 44 seconds. In reality, when you watch a video, it was 43 seconds. I said in the hearing I gave him the extra second that he wanted. But certainly he shorted somewhere. Now, I asked him if he had done the test twice as he's required, each eye twice, and he said yes. Clearly, he either didn't do them twice or he did not administer them properly. When moving the stimulus, for instance, if you were to move it very quickly, there is a nystagmus that's optical kinetic nystagmus, which is causes your eye to have nystagmus when you move a stimulus too fast for the eye to follow and out of sight line. So we don't know what exactly happened here, but what we do know is he certainly didn't do this test properly, not even close.
So if we were to say 68 seconds, if you take at least 68 seconds, it can be substantial compliance. We're not saying strictly that you must always take 68 seconds when you do this test, correct?
That's correct. And my thought would be that, and in fact, any complicating factors would make him take longer than 68 seconds, not shorter. And that's often discussed, that there's almost like a slush factor, I guess you would call it, in because of the road conditions and time of night, whatever. However, like I said, those would only serve to lengthen it. They would not shorten it.
Mr. Coker, you've got less than half your time left, and we haven't gotten the certified question yet. What is your response to Justice Cupp's interest there, pointing out that there's nothing in the record here that tells us, except for briefs in the NHTSA attachment, the Mad Mother's brief, that tells us anything about the PBT test? Should we decide the case? I mean, there's a conflict in the districts. We've got the case here. What do we do in the absence of a record?
Chief Justice, I would argue that there is no conflict with this case. This case does not demonstrate that there's a conflict. In the trooper's testimony, he has no idea what the manufacturer is, what the model is. He has no idea what the device was. He called it a PBT. Now, that was in response to a question by the prosecutor. I don't know what it was.
So is there no conflict because in the other cases, there is evidence of what the PBT is?
There's some foundational something.
And here we don't have that.
Correct. In this case, we don't know what it is. We don't know if the trooper was trained on it, if he's certified on it. We don't know if it's been calibrated. We don't know if it's been maintained. I don't know if the trooper didn't just slap this together in his garage with some duct tape and call it a PBT.
So I guess your argument is that we accepted the certified question in error because there's really not a record upon which we can determine whether there's even a conflict with the other districts.
Yes, that's correct.
I hate to put us in that position because it needs to be decided. It seems to me it's an issue. It needs to be decided. Can't we decide it without having a record?
Chief Justice, I don't see a way that it can be decided other than by way of maybe dicta through this case. But in this case, We don't have any information regarding this PBT. If it was a PBT, I don't know what it was.
Then the Seventh District's opinion as to whether that it's not admissible is also dicta and advisory. If there's no record here, there was no record there. So if they said it could not be used, then that would be in error because there was nothing to base that on. Would that not be correct?
Well, actually, the opinion by the Seventh District is still proper because it is the state's burden regarding this preliminary breath test. I raised it in my motion to suppress. It is their burden. If they don't produce the evidence by clear and convincing evidence, then it's excluded. It's deemed inadmissible. So that is still a proper ruling. I believe this is not the proper case to issue a bright line rule regarding the PBT.
But neither do we want to leave out their conclusory statements that they're never admissible. Can we modify the opinion to say on this record it's not, but we strike the finding that in all cases it's not and wait for a better day and a better case?
If I may, maybe this will also help with that situation. When the prosecutor examined the trooper regarding this device, he asked the trooper, does this device show whether or not the defendant ingested alcohol? And the trooper said yes. That's all he asked him. And asked if this specific test showed that Ms. DeRove ingested alcohol. And he said yes. The fact is, she admitted to having one beer. This preliminary breath test in this case is irrelevant. It's showing nothing. It adds nothing to the probable cause determination because the trooper didn't say she failed the preliminary breath test. He didn't say the preliminary breath test registered a certain number or a red light came on. All he said was that she ingested alcohol. That does not add to the probable cause determination because he already relied on her saying that she had one beer.
Wasn't there a number that was cited?
No, there was not.
There was no?
No. Justice Conner, in this case, in cases, there are several different PBT devices. Some of them show reading, some of them show pass-fail, some of them show green, yellow, and red light. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what this instrument was, but this trooper never testified that she failed the test. For all we know, she passed the PBT in this instance.
Those results, however, are not they're not approved by use of the Ohio Department of Health for any purpose.
That's correct. And the Department of Health, contrary to the state's position, is the only agency that can determine what devices and methods are used for evidentiary breath testing. And in fact, in answer to Justice Cupp's earlier question for the state, the NHTSA manual, it's on page Roman numeral 7-8 and 9, discusses the limitations regarding the preliminary breath testing devices and lists several of them, which include two different situations where a higher reading can be shown on a PBT, such as if you had residual mouth alcohol. When you're, as Justice Stratton was talking about with the certified breathalyzer back at the station, they have to wait 15, or they have to have a 20-minute waiting time where they observe the defendant before they take that test. That is to allow mouth alcohol to dissipate, which takes 15 to 20 minutes. That's also found in the manual.
Mr. Coker, Mr. Huey wanted some time. You've used all of your time, but I'll give Mr. Huey a minute since we've taken a lot of your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Huey.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I want to make a couple points in terms of responding to some of the questions. To make it clear, Mr. Coker is not advocating that this court find that it takes a minimum of 68 seconds to do the HGN test. All Mr. Coker is advocating is that the Court of Appeals did not err in finding that it would take a minimum of 68 seconds to do, as per the officer's testimony in the motion hearing. So I think that it would be a great error for this court to find that it takes a minimum of 68 seconds or that it takes 55 seconds. Based on the record we have here, I think that the court can conclude that based on the calculations that were done with the officer's testimony, that it should have taken him at least 68 seconds to do this individual test. The reason, Justice Pfeiffer, that the videotape is important is that all we know from the videotape is the time it started and the time it ended. So we don't know what kind of passes he did. All we can ascertain is exactly how long it took. If we had a videotape, we could probably get a little more into his technique. But all we know is how long it took. And then, so counsel cannot see how he performed the test. All he can do is ask the officer, and he walks the officer through it and says, this would take, based on the manual, using references to the manual, would you agree that this takes this long? Well, I guess it does. And would you agree that this takes this long? And he was able to come up with, from the officer's own testimony, that he did, it took 68 seconds. I think it would be wrong for this court to find that in every case it should take 68 seconds or it takes less than 68 seconds. Additionally, because the officer admits in this case that he did it improperly. And if you actually went through the record, you could find a number of instances where he did the test improperly, but he clearly admits that he did not stop and look for onset prior to 45 degrees, which is doing the test improperly. I'd hate to see this court issue a ruling saying it takes X amount of time, whatever it is, to do a test when the testimony in the court below is that the officer did it improperly to begin with, and now we're taking it using an improper test as the standard for how long it should take.
Counsel, can you get away from the whole number issue if you just find that that it was fatal to the administration of the test? In other words, substantial compliance was not met, even the very low threshold.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in addition to that, and I would like to again address Justice Stratton's question about substantial compliance versus strict compliance.
Quickly.
I'd ask the court not to go back to strict compliance, but I'd ask the court to reread its decision and consider its decision in State versus Burnside, where the court looked at substantial versus strict compliance and found that substantial compliance isn't what the Court of Appeals have been thinking it was for about 20 years. In Burnside, this court said, unanimous decision, said that substantial compliance is practically strict compliance except where it's shown that it's impracticable or impossible to strictly comply. So substantial compliance is particularly when you've got an HGN test or something that is scientifically based, although employed by a layman, substantial compliance has to be something, you know, pretty close to strict compliance unless they show that they can't strictly comply. So I argue that the standard in Burnside would require us to look at a pretty high burden for substantial compliance. I would like to note that the officer did state at the end of his testimony that the average test takes 45 to 50 seconds. However, he didn't say any basis for that whatsoever. He simply just said, I believe the average test takes 45 to 50 seconds. Mr. Coker gave an opportunity to say, well, what do you base that upon? And he didn't come to that. I would like to move on to the preliminary breath
test
issue.
Actually, you're about to move away from the podium. Your time is well up.
Thank you,
Mr. Huey. Mr. Rivera, you saved a little more than 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I just want to start with the horizontal gaze nystagmus test quickly. When the NHTSA manual talks about approximate times, it talks about approximately 4 seconds. It's the state's belief, had an arresting officer perhaps used 3 seconds to move the stimulus from left to right or right to left, you're talking 3 seconds each time that's conducted, twice each eye, that's 4 times per test. You're talking 4 times 3 different stages. You're talking a possible shaving of 12 seconds. In that scenario, an officer would still be in substantial compliance and within the NHTSA manual. Therefore, the state would agree with Attorney Huey that there should not be a minimum time requirement. But in this case, the officer agreed to Attorney Coker's calculation, not that he should have taken 68 seconds. He testified that he complied with each stage being the smooth pursuit and the maximum deviation. The only stage that the Attorney Martin testified to not doing was the stop and verifying during the onset of nystagmus prior to 45
Counsel,
seconds.
Counsel, I don't think the other side is quite getting, and certainly Justice Cupp told you, we're interested in this case because of the Fields test with the machine.
I understand.
We wouldn't have been taking this case in to quibble about seconds on one field sobriety test, I don't think. The statement was made by counsel for the defense that there's no indication at all of what the result of that machine test out on the roadway was. Didn't the officer make an arrest report, those three or four pages that they fill out about everything that happened?
If he did, it was not submitted into the record. And to answer that question, I did concede that the record is scant of whether it was reliable in this case.
Well, how do you folks prosecute these cases?
In this case?
Yeah.
In this case, it was believed that the officer substantially complied, with the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, which would give her probable cause to arrest. In that case, the PBT would be basically a side note, and you still have the probable cause to arrest, then you take her to the station, and she submits to the stationary BAC machine. I mean, that's why we prosecute this case as, and it's the state, we will not, the state is not here saying that the PBT is the sole basis for probable cause. Admittedly, there's absolutely no justification for that conclusion.
You can have probable cause without using a field sobriety test.
Absolutely.
And the Seventh District here honed in on that as being fatal to the probable cause because of all the shortcomings that are becoming abundantly clear as we go on here this morning. And what your position is that it was not fatal to the finding of probable cause. In fact, it sounds like the breathalyzer, the field sobriety, or excuse me, the field breathalyzer is really not even relevant here.
That's absolutely a possibility as other district courts have recognized that it's, simply harmless error, the ones that have not recognized this. In this case, with the HGN test being admissible and substantial compliance, we would not need the portable breath test, and probable cause would have been established.
Well, the Court of Appeals says in paragraph 10 of its opinion, as part of the state's proof that the officer had probable cause to arrest DeRoe, the state introduced the result of a portable breath test, which DeRoe took prior to the arrest. DeRoe challenged the admission of the portable breath test results, the evidence of the suppression hearing, and then it goes on to talk about what different courts have done. So I guess the results of the PBT were introduced, but no foundation for what produced those results. That
was correct, and I agree with Attorney Coker on that point, that the officer testified that the PBT indicated alcohol that was ingested, and there was no further expanding on whether she passed or failed. So maybe the Court of Appeals maybe read that testimony incorrectly as a pass-fail.
Thank you, Mr. Coker.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye.